This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents Keep Her Safe, a novel by Sophie Hanna. Performed by Fiona Hardingham, Caitlin Kelly, and Nicole Poole.
Prologue. For the longest time, I thought my sister Emery was the lucky one. Sometimes, I still feel that way. She died before they could kill her. No life at all is better than a life spent waiting to die. The hardest thing is when the kind smiles promise I'll survive. Not just another day or week, but until I'm an adult. Maybe even until I'm old, if that's true. But it can't already be true if it hasn't happened yet. If it does in the future, I'll have to stop envying the sister I never met and start feeling guilty because I made it and she didn't. I've gotten this far, but that means nothing. I can't allow myself to hope. Which I guess means I shouldn't believe the kind smiles. Once the tiniest doubt creeps in, you start to wonder about everything. When I'm alone, I whisper over and over, my name is Melody Choppa. My name is Melody Choppa. It makes me feel worse. As if the girl trying to convince me must have a different name, though there's no one there but me.
Part 1. Chapter 1. October 9th, 2017. If I could turn and run, I would. Run back home, however long it took. 6 months, probably, and I'd need to be able to sprint across the Atlantic Ocean. My legs twitch with the urge to race back to Patrick, Jess, and Ollie and pretend none of this ever happened. Not that anything has really happened yet. So far, all I've done is fly and land. I'm standing outside a cafe called Lola Coffee in the arrivals hall at Phoenix Sky Harbor Airport in Arizona, waiting for the hire car man. All around me are people in dark suits, brightly coloured T-shirts with underarm sweat stains, crumpled linen dresses, checked shorts with bulging pockets. I spot the man who had the seat across the aisle from me on the second of my two flights. He snored most of the way from Chicago, where I changed planes to Phoenix, oblivious to the flight attendants tactfully lifting his belly to check that his seatbelt was fastened. One by one, the other passengers stride confidently out of the airport, or else they linger to hug loved ones who have come to meet them. They all sound relieved and happy as they say, "Let's go home," in a dozen different ways. No one's saying it to me. As an experiment, I whisper the words to myself. They sound like a threat. Breathe. Stop thinking crazy thoughts. Be patient. Count away the panic. 1, 2, 3, 4... The hire car man is 35 minutes late. I try to persuade myself this might be a good thing. It means I'm off the hook. I can decide not to wait any longer, and I won't be letting him down. If I want to book myself on the next flight back to Heathrow, I'm in the perfect place. There's nothing stopping me, apart from a decision I made. The right decision. Just because it's hard doesn't make it wrong. Where the hell is he? He promised he'd be here. I've paid for the car already. It's 10:05 p.m. Arizona time and 6:05 in the morning in England. I've missed a night's sleep, which probably explains why I can feel myself swaying from side to side in my attempt to stand still. Driving on the wrong side of the road for the first time in my life is going to be fun, assuming I ever have something to drive. I don't want to think that I've ruined everything before I've gone anywhere or achieved anything, but it's a conclusion I have to keep batting away as I wait and wait, and still no one appears, I should have hired a car the way most people do, from one of the companies at the Phoenix airport, but they were also expensive, and I'd spent bone-chilling amounts of money on this, whatever it is I'm doing already. So I opted instead for the suspiciously good-value internet advert with the cheesy typeface. The best cars, dirt cheap, delivered to wherever you are. I pull my phone out of my bag and stare at it. Should I switch it out of flight-safe mode so that I can text the hire car man? No, out of the question. I wouldn't have the willpower to ignore all the texts from Patrick and Jess, Jess especially. She and I are the proficient communicators of the family. She, more than Patrick, would know how to craft a message that would leave me no choice but to reply. Ollie won't have sent a text. He'll assume there's nothing he can do, that Patrick and Jess will be saying all that needs to be said. For some reason, it's the thought of Ollie doing nothing that fills my eyes with tears. Mum's gone. Oh well, she might come back. I'll wait and see, I suppose. I throw my phone back in my bag, hands shaking. Maybe I should go for a walk to calm myself down. There's a corridor of shops branching off from the main arrivals hall. I can see a bookshop called Hudson and something called Canyon News. I can't imagine summoning the concentration required to read, but I might feel differently in a few days, once I've had time to adjust to the idea that I've done the one thing, the only thing, that I would never do. I should buy a book. Definitely. To read by the pool at the resort. Pools plural. There are several, according to the website. Also, if I want the hire car man to turn up, I ought to walk away. As soon as I move from this spot, he will appear. Isn't that the way life works? I'll walk 4 paces and turn round, and there he'll be, holding up a sign with my name on it. Either that, or there are no secret rules governing our interactions with other people, and we'll miss each other. He'll leave, and I'll end up taking a cab to the resort, but only after I've wasted another hour waiting for a man who's already come and gone. I sigh and look at my phone again. Surely I could go out of flight mode for the 20 seconds it would take to ring him. If I did that and didn't allow myself to look at how many texts were waiting for me... impossible. Once I knew for certain that I had messages, I'd have to read them. With my thumb, I press the pictures icon on my phone screen and scroll through my photos until I find my favourite one of Jess and Ollie. They're sitting on the old tractor in the garden of the Greyhound pub, looking so perfectly like themselves. Ollie's mouth is open and his arms are in the air, mid-gesture. He's trying to explain to me how best to hit marker a trick shot. As I took the photo, I said, "How to what a what?" Jess is sitting in front of Ollie, straight-backed, chin tilted upward. She's grinning at my bewilderment from her position of superiority as someone who speaks fluent Ollie. Seconds after I took the photo, he sighed and slid off the tractor with a resigned,
"Never mind, Mum. You wouldn't understand."
Jess said,
"Of course you wouldn't. Not everyone is a member of the sniping community."
"In a game, Mum, not in real life," she added, seeing my worried expression.
"Ollie's not really a sniper."
I press my eyes shut. No way for any tears to squeeze out, however hard they try. "Get a grip, Kara." My own stupid fault for looking at family photos. Jess and Ollie will be fine at home with Patrick. Am I seriously going to spend the next fortnight mooning over their pictures as if I'm not going to see them for years? It's only 2 weeks. 2 short, insignificant weeks. I'll be back home before we all know it. I should put my phone away and not think about it again. Instead, I swipe right with my finger until I'm staring, for the 300th time since I set off, at the last photo I took before leaving home. It's an aerial view of the note I left on the kitchen table. My family won't know that the version they read was my 4th attempt. I try to explain too much the first 3 times. In the end, hating everything I'd written, I decided to keep it short and simple. "Dear Patrick, Jess and Ollie, I've gone away for a while. I didn't tell you before I left because I was scared you'd try and stop me. I need time alone to sort a few things out in my head. Please don't be angry. I'll be back on Tuesday, 24th of October. I love you all very much. Kara/Mum. XXX. It's comforting to see it again in black and white, the date I'll be home. That's why I keep looking, I think. Thank goodness I took this photo before I set out for Heathrow. I nearly didn't bother. Without concrete evidence in the form of a picture, I would by now have convinced myself I'd written something terrible that I didn't mean and could never take back. Dear Patrick, Jess and Ollie, you have finally succeeded in driving me away. It will serve you right if you never see me again." Behind me I hear a chair leg scrape against a hard surface. I turn and watch a man lower himself into a seat at one of the cafe's tables. He's young, early to mid-twenties, with dark hair and a wispy beard, baggy terracotta-coloured jeans with turned-up ends, sandals with running shoe soles, and a grey T-shirt that says, Rock the Hole, next to a picture of a hole on a golf course with a flag protruding from it. On the table in front of him there's a sign with my name on it, though he spelled my surname wrong, B-U-R-R-O-U-G-H-S, instead of B-U-R-R-O-W-S. He's staring straight ahead, avoiding eye contact with me, as if the two of us have nothing to do with each other. For a second, I wonder why he hasn't worked out that the only other person anywhere near Lola Coffee must be the woman he's supposed to be meeting there. Then I get it. His brief doesn't include working anything out. All he's paid to do is turn up at the airport with the car I've hired and a sign with something resembling my name on it. Both of those things, he's done. Why should he try harder? Patrick, my husband, whose official title should be patron saint of the can't be asked to do any more than the bare minimum, would defend Mr. Rock the Hole for sure, using a version of his famous in our family cutlery divider defence. Shortly after we got married, I tactfully pointed out to him that he might in future return clean forks to the fork section of the cutlery drawer, knives to the knife section, spoons to the spoon area, and so on, instead of throwing them all in haphazardly and letting them land wherever. He sighed and said, Cara, I put away a lot of cutlery. Mostly things end up where they're supposed to, but if something falls into the wrong bit, I'm not going to dig it out and move it to a different section. He said it as if doing this would be anyone's definition of insanity. Approximately 12 years later, his perfectionist daughter got sick of reaching into the cutlery drawer for a yogurt spoon and pulling out a steak knife instead, and gave him a savaging he still hasn't forgotten. Ever since, our forks, knives and spoons have known their places. I blink back new tears, no more thoughts of home allowed, not tonight, and introduce myself to Rock the Hole, who neither apologises for his lateness nor offers to help carry my luggage. It's warm outside, verging on hot, as if Phoenix is trying to fake an October night and not putting much effort into the pretense. I remember from the website that my hire car is supposed to have something called climate control, which I'm hoping means air conditioning. It must be the same thing. I know next to nothing about cars, apart from the absolute basics of how to drive them. The air here smells nothing like at home. I wonder if this is a specifically Arizona smell. Does New York smell different? And Chicago? I've never been to America before, so I have no way of knowing. The car is a Range Rover, black and glossy, with three parallel silver stripes on each side. It looks and smells brand new. We sit in the front, me in the driver's seat, and Rock the Hole next to me to do the paperwork. His handwriting is a bit like Patrick's, incomplete circles for O's, A's and E's, like broken links in a chain. I wonder how surprised he'd be if I smiled knowingly and said, I can imagine what your cutlery drawer looks like. Having covered the basics of how the car works, he starts to describe in a bored drawl its unnecessary features. 8 different colour options for the interior lighting, retractable sunroof, memory buttons numbered M1 to M4, so that 4 driver's seat positions can be stored. Hasn't he noticed I'm alone? The car might be ready and able to remember 4 people, but it'll have to make do with only one. It's a shame. Ollie would love these lights, which can be orange 1 minute and bright green the next. You can still go home. You can step out of the car and... I need you to do me a favour, I say to Rock before I have a chance to change my mind. Pulling my phone out of my bag, I hand it to him and say, Keep this for me. Give it back when I drop the car off in 2 weeks. I'll pay you an extra $100, 50 now, 50 when I get my phone back. Okay, he shrugs, not even a tiny bit curious. Now that he's agreed, I'm not sure I want to do it. How many decisions made and immediately regretted can a woman be expected to stand by in 1 week? Rock holds out his hand. I throw my phone at it harder than I need to. Take that, doubts! It's the only way. If I have it with me, I'll crack in a few hours or a few days and read all the texts that are waiting for me. I won't be strong enough to resist the pleas for me to come home. Thank you, I mumble. $50, lady. Rock holds out his hand again. I give him the money, wishing I'd offered an extra $10 for the right to say, You will look after it properly, won't you? I didn't, so I keep my mouth shut. I'm going to have to trust him, or stop caring about what happens to my phone, one or the other. Finally, he says,
"Okay, you're all done."
He gets out of the car and slams the passenger door shut without saying goodbye. I've never felt more alone in my life, or more awake. A fizzing mix of fear and excitement, combined with the underlying exhaustion, makes me feel dizzy and nauseous. I open my bag, pull out the driving directions I printed last night, and unfold them. "Ready to go," I say to nobody. This is truly happening. I, Cara Burrows from Hertford, England, am on my way to the 5-star Swallowtail Resort and Spa in the foothills of Camelback Mountain, Arizona, without my family's knowledge or permission. To most people, I would look like a woman setting off on the holiday of a lifetime, not one escaping from an unbearable situation. If Ollie and the children are angry when I next see them, if they scream and shout at me, I'll survive. So will they. That's why I'm here. It's the only reason. I need us to survive. All of us. It's 10 past midnight by the time I arrive at the resort. The GPS on my hire car is broken, it turned out, and I had to pull over twice to memorize the next stage of my directions. At one point, I took a wrong turn, thinking, this is probably going to be wrong. I bet it's wrong. It was 20 minutes before I could safely turn around and get back on track, and then I promptly got lost again and ended up driving God knows where for another 40 minutes. A journey that should have taken me half an hour took me nearly 2 hours. Now, finally, I'm here and I hardly dare breathe. I can no longer tell myself I'm on my way somewhere. This is it. I've arrived. Whatever's supposed to happen at the Swallowtail Resort and Spa, the magic, indefinable thing that will make all my problems go away, could and should and, please God, will start happening now. Soon. Not right now, as in immediately this second. Setting unrealistic goals is only going to make me feel worse, and I'm pretty sure no life-changing revelation has ever happened in a car park. I pull into a space, throw open the door, twist my body around so that my legs are outside the car, and look out at the night. Now that I'm here, and the adrenaline rush of handling a strange car on the wrong side of the road in an unknown country has drained away, the tiredness I managed to keep at bay while driving takes hold of me, weighing me down, making patches of my skin ache. The night sparkles with so many stars, it looks staged, like a set in a theatre. I never see any at home, never have time to look. I stare at the dark outline of what I assume is Camelback Mountain. I can't see you yet, but I know you're beautiful, I whisper, and start to cry. Cut it out right now, Cara. Get to your room and then you can do it all. Cry, get something to eat, have a relaxing bath, sleep, wish you hadn't given your phone to a rude stranger. Getting to my room might be more of a challenge than I anticipated. The scale of the car park suggests that the Swallowtail Resort might be the size of a small town. It could be bigger than Hartford, come to think of it. As well as a sign saying Main Hotel Building / Reception. I've already seen several suggesting there are lots of different residential areas here. Copper Stall Villas, Monarch Suites, Swallowtail Village, The Residence, Camelback, Casitas. The sign I saw for reception was quite a way back. I close my eyes thinking of the effort it will take to wheel my suitcases back to that point, and God alone knows how long a walk it will be from there to my room. I'm not sure I can do it. Not tonight, at least. I could fall asleep here, quite happily, with the car door open to the warm night. Maybe one of the M1 to M4 driver's seat position buttons contains a memory of how to stretch out flat, like a bed. The sound of an engine makes me sit up straight. Is it another guest arriving? The noise moves nearer, then stops. No, it isn't a car. The wrong pitch and not loud enough. A lawnmower, maybe. One of those big ones you sit on and drive around if you've got a big field to cut. But at this time of night, I hear footsteps coming closer. A man's voice says,
"Ma'am, I bet you're the lady I've been waiting for. Mrs. Cara Burrows from Hartford, England. Last guest of the night. Am I right?"
The sound of his voice makes me feel so much better. It's the opposite of Rock the Hole's indifferent drone. I think it might be the most reassuring voice I've ever heard. Disembodied in the dark, it makes me smile before I've seen the face it's attached to. "Yes, I'm Cara Burrows.
Sorry, I'm later than I said I'd be.
No need whatsoever to apologize, ma'am. I'm just real glad you're here now. Welcome to Arizona and to the Swallowtail Resort and Spa. You're gonna have a beautiful stay with us, I can promise you that. All our guests do.
Of course they do, when you're paying that much. I push away the thought I've managed to avoid so far, how much all this is going to cost. A third of the savings has taken Patrick and me 15 years to build up. Oh, God. It's worse when I think of it like this. Worse than the specific sum of money. So irresponsible. A whole third. I could have chosen somewhere less luxurious to stay and at least 5 times cheaper. Could have booked a week instead of a fortnight. Could have. Should have. I didn't, though. This is what I did. This was my choice. The best place I could find. Money, no object. I wouldn't have thought it was possible to feel proud and ashamed at the same time, but it is. Guilt and defiant pride have been battling it out inside me since I booked the trip. I economized around the edges, not only by choosing a dodgy-looking hire car firm, but also on the flights. One change in both directions, saving nearly £700, and I regretted it. If I had any self-respect, I'd have spared myself the 3 pointless hours at Chicago's O'Hare Airport. I hear a click. Light from an electric torch turns the night yellow. The man with the best voice in the world leans down and smiles at me. He's 50-odd, bald, and wearing a blazer with a Swallowtail Resort and Spa badge on it and 5 gold stars. Beneath this is another badge that says Diggy. The skin of his face is craggy-looking in places and pouchy in others, as if it were designed to include distinct hard and soft zones.
"Pleasure to meet you, ma'am. I'm Diggy. That's what everyone calls me. Now, much as I'd be happy to show you around tonight, it's pretty dark, and I'm guessing you're tired, and maybe you'd rather leave it till tomorrow. So, why don't we get you to reception? I've got a club car here. Drive you right there. No need to walk at Swallowtail if you'd rather get a ride. Tomorrow, once you're rested, give the concierge desk a call. Tell them you're ready for Diggy's tour." I'll come pick you up from wherever you're staying and show you everything you need to see. How does that sound? The Diggy-mobile will be at your service.
Brilliant. Thank you. I watch, amazed, as he picks up my luggage as if it's weightless and slings it into the back of a sort of golf buggy. It has silver wheels, white leather seats, open sides, and a kind of cream canvas awning on the top. I climb aboard. Diggy switches off his torch and leaps into the driver's seat, saying,
"All aboard the Diggy-mobile!"
I haven't got a watch or my phone, so I don't know how long it takes us to trundle along to reception, but it's between 5 and 10 minutes. Out of the car park and along a series of winding roads, with little golden-white globes of light behind cobbled borders on both sides to point the way in the dark. We pass low houses, some facing us straight on, some turned to the side, with curved edges, terraces, balconies, neat front gardens behind low walls. I catch a glimpse of moonlight reflected in water, lean out of the club car and see a small square swimming pool behind one of the villas. All kinds of shrubbery sprout haphazardly at the side of each curvy street. I wasn't expecting it. I've always thought of Arizona as dry and desert-like. As we pass a cluster of tennis courts on the right, a rotating sprayer shoots a refreshing mist into the club car from the left, a haze of water that lands on my face. Sprinklers. That's what makes all this lush greenery possible. There are cacti, too, lots of them. Some that look like eruptions of spikes in large pots, others twice my height or more, protruding from flat, gravelled over areas, as if they've grown out of the stone. These tall ones stand in clusters. Some have arms that look raised, as if they're waving. Diggy points this out to me at the very moment that I'm thinking it.
"They look like they're saying hello and welcome, don't they? You know how long it takes one of those arms to start growing? 70 to 100 years. 70 minimum.
We pass a fountain and some wide steps, a row of high palm trees with fairy lights wound around their trunks all the way to the top, glowing pale pink and pale blue. Lower down I can see the corner of an illuminated rectangle of vivid turquoise that must be one of the resort pools. A few metres farther on, when I turn and look the other way, I see 2 tall cast-iron lampposts topped by large shallow bowls that have been set alight. Actual fire is rising from them, orange flames rising to a point, making a glowing triangle on each side of, What? It looks like some sort of entrance. Wow, I mutter.
Yeah, that's our maze, says Diggy. Make sure to get lost in it while you're here. It's one of Swallowtail's most popular features. You only get the flames at night, though, which doesn't make it any easier to find your way out than in the daytime. I gotta warn you.
Eventually, the club car stops outside a building that's much bigger than any of the individual houses we've passed. Its facade is a half circle with two long wings branching out from it.
Here we are, ma'am, says Diggy. I'll introduce you to Rihanna. She'll take real good care of you.
He strolls toward the building with my cases. Watching him, it dawns on me that I need to walk too. My limbs have been asleep and soon start to ache from the shock of having to move again after bobbing along in the club car. I wish the resort had the indoor equivalent, taking guests all the way to their rooms. I follow Diggy into a spacious lobby area that's all red marble with thin white and black veins in it. I might see it differently in the morning, but tonight it makes me think of the inside of a body. There are tall potted plants positioned in every corner, more like little trees, with rubbery dark green leaves and sturdy brown trunks. They look too alert for the way I feel. Behind the wooden reception desk, there's a wide-shouldered black woman about my age, with a big smile and the kind of braids that I'm pretty sure are called cornrows. Like Diggy, she has a swallowtail badge on her jacket, along with one that says, Rihanna Briggs. She seems genuinely delighted to see me, and I hope she doesn't say anything too kind or solicitous. I'd burst into tears if she did. I smile weakly as I hand over my passport and credit card. Each movement is difficult, every impression a blur. I knock something on the desk with my elbow, and it hurts. Looking down, I see it's a tiny bronze Buddha statue, sitting cross-legged beside some kind of weird, messy plant. Is it a cactus? It doesn't look hard-edged or prickly enough. It looks as if someone's cooked a load of green beans and then tipped them haphazardly into a yellow ceramic pot. The Buddha, facing straight ahead as if determined to ignore the weird bean cactus, has a pile of ivory-coloured Swallowtail Resort business cards balanced on the upturned palms of his hands, as if to say, "Spend your money here and all the wisdom will be yours." It's clever marketing, I suppose, but it makes me shudder. Or perhaps it's the exhaustion that's doing that. Rihanna's eyes are full of curiosity, and for a moment I'm afraid she's going to lean forward and say,
"So, what's wrong with you? Life falling apart? Run away from home?"
How do most guests behave who arrive in the middle of the night? I can't imagine they're full of beans and eager to chat. Luckily, Rihanna keeps it businesslike. I try to look as if I'm listening as she tells me about Wi-Fi codes and breakfast times. I don't need to know. Sleep is the only thing I care about. Tell me about sleep. Diggy takes his leave after repeating his promise to show me around tomorrow. No, the day after, please. I can't promise to wake up in time for tomorrow. Rihanna folds a piece of cardboard in half and inserts a plastic key card into the slit. I was wrong. She's not my age. More like 10 years older. Late 40s. There are lines around her eyes that she's tried very hard to cover with makeup. I nod automatically at everything she says, not really listening, and start slightly as she moves out from behind the reception desk, holding my room key in her hand. She's short, shorter than I imagined her to be, even in her stiletto heels. Strange, sitting down, she looked taller. It must have been because of her broad shoulders. You don't need to come with me, really. Thanks, I managed to say.
Are you sure? Your room's right here in the main hotel building, so it's not far.
We like to make sure guests are happy with their rooms. I'll be fine. Thanks. I hope I'm not being rude. I can't bear the thought of having to make polite conversation for a second longer. If she tags along in spite of my protests, I'm going to lie down on the red marble floor and cry. She laughs and nods.
I hear you. No problem. You go get yourself some rest.
She hands me the key and I grab it. Nearly there. I start to walk toward where the lifts ought to be, where I'd have put them if I'd designed the building. I'll have someone bring up your bags immediately, Rihanna calls after me. That's not soon enough. The last thing I want once I'm in my room is someone knocking at the door. I'd completely forgotten about my suitcases. No, it's okay, I say. I'll take them up myself. Absolutely fine, says Rihanna. Whatever you want. Oh, elevators are that way.
She points in a direction that would not have occurred to me. Clearly Swallowtail's architect and I would never agree on anything. The number on my paper key wallet begins with a 3, which I suppose means my room's on the 3rd floor. As the lift doors slide closed, I groan with relief. Nearly there now. So close. I feel numb, and therefore better. I'm too tired to think, worry, regret, miss my family. I get out on 3 and struggle to interpret the signs on the wall, though they can't be complicated. I'm just in the wrong condition to be staring at lots of numbers that begin with 3 and arrows pointing all over the place. It takes me 5 seconds longer than it should to work out that my room is right beside the lift. A sharp left turn around a corner, and I'm there. I touch the keycard against the pad on the door, and a green light flashes. I let myself in and wheel my cases into the room, swearing under my breath as I bang them against the doorframe. It's dark, but I can see I'm in a rectangular space, about 6 feet by 12, that widens out at the end. In the light that floods into the room from the corridor, I see what look like the bottom ends of 2 double beds. My fingers scrabble for a light switch. Instead, they find a small box-like structure attached to the wall. I know from family holidays in British hotels that this is the slot where I need to insert my key card if I want the lights to work. I try to put it in and find I can't. Opening the door wider for more light, I see why. There's already a card in the slot. The person who had the room before me must have left it in, and whoever made up the room didn't notice. I pull out the card, drop it on the floor, and replace it with mine. No lights come on. The door next to the key card slot has to be the bathroom, opposite the wardrobes, minibar, and safe. I open it and walk in, feeling a sudden urgent need to splash cold water on my face. The door to the corridor clunks shut, and it's suddenly pitch black in here. Fumbling for the light switch, I find nothing on the smooth, cool bathroom walls. Feels like more marble, probably red with white and black veins. I reach around to grope outside in the hallway. There must be a switch somewhere, surely, and find one eventually, lower than I expected it to be. Light at last. I was right. I'm in the bathroom. Not right, says a voice in my head as my heart starts to pound. Something is wrong in here. The room is full of somebody's possessions. A green and black one-piece swimming costume hanging from a hook on the wall. Petite woman-sized, or teenage girl, maybe. A pair of men's swimming trunks draped over the door of the glass shower stool. Lots of thin metal hair clips. 2 toothbrushes, 2 deodorants, one of those old-fashioned rubber swimming caps in a pale, pinky-beige colour, shaving foam, and an electric razor. Shit. Shit, 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 shit. Someone's here. In the room. They must be. Asleep in the beds, I saw. No one would leave this many of their possessions behind. The key card that was in the slot when I walked in. I hear a girl's voice say, I spilled coke on Poggy. And Doodle Dandy. She sounds young and upset and terrifyingly close. Because she is. Looks like I'm not the only one who's not at my best in the middle of the night. Rihanna the receptionist screwed up. This room's already occupied by someone who, in less than 20 seconds, will find me in their bathroom. What the hell do I do? Stay calm, Kara. Think fast. There's no chance of me escaping undetected, not now that someone's awake in there. All my luggage is in the hallway. No way I could get it all out quick enough. The next voice I hear is a man's. Coke, what? He sounds disorientated, as if he's being dragged from a deep sleep. You shouldn't be drinking coke in the middle of the night, honey. You brushed your teeth already.
I wasn't drinking it, the girl sounds upset, unjustly accused. I knocked it over by accident. It was on the table, left over from dinner. I was going to the bathroom to see who's in there.
No one's in there.
Yes, there is. I heard someone moving around.
Oh, shit, here it comes.
Why am I still standing here, silent and frozen, as if I might be able to wish myself elsewhere? I should have declared my presence at once, soon as I heard the girl speak.
The man says, the light's on in there. Did you switch it on?
No, the girl sounds as if she's crying. There's someone in there, I know it.
Honey, there really isn't, shh. Stay where you are, okay? I'll go check it out.
But I spilled coke on Poggy, the girl whines. Look at him.
Poggy's gonna be fine. Listen to me. Poggy will clean up and look as good as new, I promise. The coke will wash out. And there's no one in our bathroom. It was probably water pipes you heard. But let me go have a look anyway. Just so we're sure.
I shut my eyes and wait. This is going to be unbearably awful. I'm stuck in a nightmare. Please, let me wake up. What if he hits me?
What the hell are these?
His voice is so close, he must be right outside the bathroom door, staring at my two suitcases. What's wrong with me? How can I let this continue for a second longer? I have to say something now before he pushes open the door and sees me. The worst thing I can do is look as if I'm trying to get away with it, hoping not to be found. It's me. I'm in your bathroom, I call out with my eyes squeezed tightly shut. My voice is unsteady and hoarse. I'm a woman, on my own, as freaked out as you are, I swear. This is a mistake, and I'll leave immediately. I've just got off a plane from England and driven through the night. I'm exhausted, and this isn't my fault. The receptionist sent me to the wrong room, so please don't be angry with me. My name's Cara Burrows. I'm from Hartford in England, and I'm completely harmless. When I open my eyes, a man and a girl are standing in the hall outside the bathroom, staring in at me, their mouths open. They look as shaken as I feel. Neither of them lunges at me with a raised fist or a weapon. That's something to be grateful for. The man's big, with a hairy chest, muscly arms, and a bit of a belly hanging over the top of his white boxer shorts. Dark hair, bad haircut, ever so slightly too long at the sides and too short on top. I'm surprised by the girl, who looks 13, maybe a bit older. She could easily be in Jess's year at school or the year above. From what I heard when I couldn't see her, I'd have guessed she was no older than 7 or 8. What kind of 13-year-old cries because she's spilled some coke? She's wearing a long, pale green nightdress with white embroidery around the V-neck. Her face is a pale, thin, tear-streaked oval, her hair dark, long, straight, parted crookedly in the centre. With one hand, she gently rubs the top of her head near her hairline. In the other, she's clutching a pink stuffed animal. I can see what might be a coke stain, a brownish patch on one side. So, this is Poggy. He's confusing to look at, but I can see how he got his name. He has the head of a dog attached to the body of a pig. Homemade, I decide, and not in a good way. Whoever knitted him probably kidded themselves that they were creating a pig in every particular, but there's no way that isn't the face and head of a worryingly pink Staffordshire Bull Terrier.
You were given the key to this room.
The man sounds as if he's weighing up whether to believe me.
Our room.
Yes. How would I have got in otherwise? I'm so sorry. Let me get my cases out of your room and I'll leave you in peace. I move toward the bathroom door. He steps forward to block me.
Who did you say you were again?
Cara Burrows. Wife, mother, normal, non-threatening, sane person.
Mind showing me some ID?
ID? No. I don't mind. I root around in my bag, pull out my passport, and hand it to him. The girl has taken a step back out into the hall. She's still rubbing that patch on her head. Did she bang it on her way out of bed? Or is it some kind of nervous tic?
Okay, Cara Burrows. Can I take a look in your bag?
My bag?
Why?
This is getting a bit ridiculous.
You turn up in my room in the middle of the night. I'm taking no chances.
I hand him the bag. You're being paranoid. I've told you what happened. A mix-up at reception. If I was going to do anything scary, wouldn't I have done it by now? I just want to get the hell out of here, get a room that doesn't have anyone in it, and go to sleep. He turns and says to the girl,
You go back to bed, honey. Get some rest. Everything's fine. There's nothing to worry about.
She does as she's told without a word. Why does he talk to her as if she's 5 years old? Because it's night time and she was scared of the intruder? Or does he talk to her the same way over breakfast? If I spoke to Jess like that, she'd say, Will I hell go back to bed? Then she'd list all the ways in which I was handling the stranger in the bathroom situation badly and proceed to deal with it far better herself. I don't like this man. He's poking around in my bag as if we're at an airport and he's head of security.
Where's your cell?
He asks.
Pardon? Your cell phone. Don't tell me you don't own one. Everyone has a phone.
I shake my head. Unbelievable. Yes, I have a phone. I gave it to the guy from the car hire firm and asked him, paid him $100, actually, to look after it for me until I give the car back.
Why did you do that?
Tears start to prickle in my eyes. Because I didn't want to have it with me. Because I have messages waiting to ambush me the minute I turn it on, and I don't want to read them. And I knew I would if I had my phone within easy reach. And none of this is any of your business. The man hands me back my bag and holds up both his hands in a gesture of surrender.
I'm sorry, he says. Come on, though. You can't blame me for being careful under the circumstances.
Probably not, I mutter, pushing past him to get to my luggage and the escape route. Now that he's satisfied I'm not a secret agent intent on slitting his throat, he's all charm and compassion.
Here, let me hold the door for you. Or, better idea, you get the door. I'll take your cases to the elevator.
No, thanks. I can manage. In spite of my best efforts, a tear has escaped and is snaking its way down my face. I knock the doorframe again, hard, twice, as I pull my cases out into the corridor. The man looks alarmed.
Hey, don't cry. No harm done, right?
Good night. Sorry again.
Listen, Kara, what?
I didn't say he could call me by my first name. Can't he leave me alone? I'm out of his room. So are all my cases. All he has to do is shut the door, so why doesn't he?
Are you sure you're okay? You don't seem it. Are you in some kind of trouble? I couldn't help seeing the ultrasound photo.
He nods at my handbag.
If you need help...
Shit. How could I have forgotten the photo? Now he knows something about me that even my closest friends don't know. I need sleep and to be left alone, I tell him. That's all.
Tomorrow, get your cell phone back from the rental car guy. Read those messages. It's better to know, right?
Great. Unsolicited advice from a hairy-chested, half-naked stranger in a hotel corridor. I stare at him in disbelief. Did you not hear me say, I need to be left alone? He shrugs.
All right. Well, good night.
Hallelujah. Never in my life have I been so pleased to see a door close. I take the lift down to the ground floor, marked L for lobby. Rihanna's tilted her chair back and put her feet up on the desk. She leaps up when I appear, surprised to see me. There's someone in the room you gave me. Father and daughter. Excuse me? Her eyes widen, she leans forward. The room you sent me to. I'm afraid I left the key up there, but I've got... I hand her the folded cardboard wallet with the room number written on it. It's someone else's room. It's occupied. Go up and look if you don't believe me. I walked in on a man and his daughter who were fast asleep. I woke them up. Rihanna is already tapping frantically on her keyboard, her eyes darting around as if she's trying to look closely at every part of the screen at once. Her fingernails are long, carefully shaped, and painted a pale Eau de Nile colour. Oh my goodness, she murmurs after a few seconds. I am so, so sorry. Oh my word. She hits herself on the forehead, hard with the heel of her hand. What is wrong with me? I have never done that before. I can't believe I did it. It doesn't matter. I'm not interested in making her feel better. Can I have a key to a different room, please? I'm really tired. I just want to... room. She sounds horrified. Oh, you're not just getting a room. Not anymore. Mrs. Burrows, I feel so sick about putting you through this horrible experience. I really hope nothing, you know, happened. Is she asking me if the man in the already occupied room sexually assaulted me? As if that's the only way my experience could have been awful. I glare at the little bronze Buddha statue, who needn't look quite so smug about everything. I consider flicking him hard with my finger, but manage to resist the urge. Rihanna turns back to her computer screen. I'm upgrading you, for no extra charge and with our compliments, to one of our Camelback casitas. I took a call 10 minutes ago from a couple who are supposed to be here already and can't make it after all, so... You'll have your own private infinity pool on the terrace and the very best views of Camelback Mountain that Swallowtail can offer. The praying monk, too. Please accept this and my heartfelt apologies as compensation for the terrible shock you must have had. I should be grateful and excited, but Rihanna started to look tearful halfway through her little speech, and all I can think is that if she starts to cry, that will be my limit. I'll walk out of here and go and find the nearest cheap B&B, anywhere that can keep track of how many rooms they have and who's in them at any given time. Thank you, I managed to say. That's very kind of you. What did she mean about a praying monk? I don't want anyone in my casita apart from me, however devout they might be. She can't have meant an actual person. It is kind of her, though. Very. She didn't have to upgrade me quite so substantially. When I wake up late tomorrow afternoon, hopefully, I'm sure I'll be thrilled and think Rihanna Briggs is the best receptionist ever. Not at all, she says. I've put you in number 21. Let me ring for a club car. You can't walk. It's too far. Please let the driver not be diggy. Let it be someone blank-faced and bland who doesn't speak any English. I take you myself, but I am shaking, says Rihanna. I can't believe I did that. I am just so sorry. I can't bear to think what might have happened to you. Her might have grates on my worn nerves, as if what did happen wasn't bad enough. Is she afraid I'll report her to the resort manager? Do I look that mean? I can't assure her I have no intention of trying to get her fired without sounding as if I'm saying I could if I wanted to. At this point, I'm not certain any of my thoughts make sense. Might as well pack in thinking for the night. My club car driver is not quite as mute as I would like him to be, but he's considerably less talkative than Diggy and Rihanna. As we chug along the resort's winding side-lit roads, I'm braced for something to go wrong. A flat tire, a hailstorm, an ambush. But mercifully, I arrive at my casita a few minutes later without any problems. It's spacious and cool and, even better, there's no one in it. I check every room and find no hidden families stashed anywhere. I lock the door, put the chair across, and pull off items of clothing as I stumble to the nearest bedroom. I have time to say, thank God, to nobody in particular, before I black out.
The kind smiles say that Emery died so that I could live, or something like that. I don't remember the words they used, but I remember thinking it sounded like Jesus, who died for all our sins. Is that what Emery did for me? I said I didn't think it could be because she didn't do it deliberately. She didn't choose death, and nobody chose it for her. She died for no reason, without knowing I would ever be born. The kind smile smiled and said, yes, of course, I was right about that. They tried to explain that they'd meant it only as a kind of metaphor. But what they did truly believe was that sometimes, although no one causes a thing to happen with their actions, fate has a plan. And maybe fate was, and still is, determined that I should survive. I'm supposed to find this idea comforting, but I don't. If fate is so powerful, why did he make it so that only one of us could live? Couldn't he have shuffled things around so that Emery could have a chance too? It doesn't seem fair. Well, you must be the favorite child, the kind smile said. The universe's favorite. Destiny's favorite. It became their special name for me. Favorite child. I've always hated it. It feels disloyal to Emery. She's my sister, and always will be. The kind smiles don't care about Emery. Only about me. And they think I like it that way. They think it makes up for the way my parents felt about us. They tell me I'm special all the time. And beautiful. And kind. And good. I don't want to be special. Or anybody's favorite. I want to be an ordinary girl. With a sister. Part of an ordinary family.
Chapter 2. October 10th. 2017. I wake up too hot, with the sun blasting my face through the window. Didn't I shut the curtains last night? Obviously not. What time is it? With my eyes still closed, I reach out and start patting the first surface I touch to find my phone. It's a few seconds before I remember that I gave it to Rock the Hole. Damn, that was a stupid thing to do. I sit up, blinking, and look around. Green leaves press against the window all along its length to about halfway up.
I'm in the biggest bed I've ever seen. 5 people could lie in it side by side, no problem. There's a quilt that slid off onto the floor. Shiny red and gold hexagons stitched together to make a honeycomb pattern, and red and gold silk cushions in and on the bed, on the floor, on the high-backed armchair, in the corner of the room. To my left, there's a tilted fireplace, opposite the bed, a television set 4 times the size of mine at home, with shutters. They're open, and the screen has a blue box on it, displaying a message for me. "Welcome, Miss Cara Burrows. The management and staff of Swallowtail Resort and Spa wish you a delightful stay. Please contact us if there is anything further we can do to ensure that your time with us is as special as you deserve." I ran away from home without telling my family. What I deserve is, let's see, an alarming encounter with a boundary-violating man, a weird girl and woolly dog-pig hybrid in the middle of the night. The bottom right-hand corner of the TV shows the time, 1:10 p.m. I've slept for 12 hours and feel like myself again, which may or may not be a good thing. No longer smothered by fatigue, my mind starts to race. Giving up my phone was crazy, a serious mistake. What time is it in England? 8 hours later, so 9:10 in the evening. Patrick, Jess and Ollie are about to spend their second night without me. How are they all feeling? What are they thinking and saying? I could know the answers to these questions if only I hadn't given my phone to a random stranger. I left a note so they wouldn't worry, but what if they're worried anyway? Really, seriously, desperately worried, as I would be if Patrick did what I've done. Jess might never forgive me. Ollie and Patrick don't remember every tiny slight the way she does. She hoards grievances. Her ex-best friend, Newella, was cut off for watching the final episode of Pretty Little Liars without Jess after promising not to, and hasn't been seen at our house since. What I've done is so much worse. I'm the world's worst mother. The man with a hairy chest could see it as clearly as he saw my suitcases in his hotel room. That's why he gave me unasked-for advice, because he could see it was an emergency, that I was about to ruin my whole life. I take a deep breath, start again. If all I do in Arizona is make myself suffer, I'll have wasted a hell of a lot of money. That's not going to happen. I won't let it. I got these 2 weeks that I went to the trouble of stealing from my real life, and I'm damn well going to make them count. In a good way. Yesterday I didn't feel strong enough to receive messages from my family. Today, after my 12-hour sleep, I do. If they scream at me to come home immediately, I'll calmly explain that I'm not ready yet and that I'll be home on Tuesday the 24th of October. It would be nice to talk to them, though, and reassure them as far as I can. It would make what I'm doing feel less extreme. And I don't need to contact Rock the Hole and get my mobile. I can ring home from a landline. There's a phone on my bedside table. It occurs to me that the resort must have a business center. I'd rather email than phone, I think. The first time, at least, until I've been assured that a phone call won't lead to a barrage of accusations. I'll make contact after breakfast. Or lunch, I suppose I should call it. Eating comes first. I'm so hungry. I feel hollow. There's a room service menu standing up on the desk beneath the TV, drawing attention to itself. But I'd rather go out and see a bit of the resort. The website said there were 5 restaurants. I might as well try one. I shower, dress, brush my teeth, and pull what I need for today out of a suitcase. Faded blue one-piece swimsuit, sunglasses, green caftan, pink flip-flops. Unpacking can wait. It seems wrong to go out without first exploring this amazing little house that I've got all to myself. Was the embarrassment and irritation of last night worth it for this upgrade? Definitely not. Not today. Though I'm pretty sure if I ask myself the same question in 2 days' time, my answer will be different. Last night I only checked for unwelcome roommates and took in almost nothing else about the casita. I didn't notice the wicker basket in the shape of a flower, piled high with fruit and tied up in a pink satin bow, or the bottles of still and sparkling water like blown glass sculptures, curving cylinders that look as if they've been artfully twisted in the middle. I didn't see the little cream-coloured box, also tied with pink ribbon, with 4 chocolates nestling in a bed of pink satin inside. This place is unbelievable. The TV embedded in the living room wall is even bigger than the one in my bedroom. There's a sliding door that takes up most of the back wall of the living and kitchen area. Through the glass, I catch a glimpse of a tantalizing turquoise rectangle, my own pool. Jess can't know about this, ever. If she found out I had my own swimming pool at a resort I went to without her, no, it doesn't bear thinking about. I slide open the door and step out onto the tiled terrace. Outside is a surprise after the quiet of inside. The hum of birds and other creatures is strong and hypnotic. I could stay here listening to it all day if I weren't starving. Maybe a quick dip in the pool, but no, I want to see my other swimming choices first. This is five-star resort maths, dividing your days between the number of beautiful pools available. It's hard to see how any could be more stunning than this one. It's an infinity pool with two blue sides that look rough, as if they'd scratch your palms if you rubbed your hands over them, and two shiny black sides that look smoother than any surface I've seen before. The rough with the smooth. I can almost hear the architect thinking those words. The infinity edge of the pool offers what has to be the best possible view of Camelback Mountain. I can't imagine a better one. I spot a section of rock jutting out near to the top that looks as if it could be a person slightly bent down, as if bowing to the mountain summit and say, "Ha!" Quietly as I realize, this must be the praying monk that Rihanna mentioned. How can it not be? I go back inside and close the door. At the center of a long coffee table of dark polished wood, there's a leather folder, the front of which is embossed with Swallowtail's logo, a capital S composed entirely of tiny butterflies. I'm too hungry to look at everything properly now, but I pull out a couple of information sheets, fold them, and put them in my bag. I can read them over lunch. The casita's second bedroom is almost identical to the one I slept in last night, except the colour scheme is blue and silver, not red and gold. The effect is less dazzling, more calming. I sit down on the edge of the bed. A corner of the little terrace pool is visible through the window, which probably explains the choice of blue for the decor in here. I could divide my nights between the two rooms, more resort maths, but even as I have the idea, I know I won't do it. I already think of the red and gold room as mine. Patrick, if I told him this, would say this is my whole problem, that I grow attached to things too quickly. I don't like the idea of this beautiful blue and silver bedroom going to waste for 2 weeks, so I make a decision. This is where I'll do my thinking. Every day I'll spend at least an hour in here, sitting on this bed, or maybe lying on it, actively focusing on my situation and working out what I want to do about it. The rest of the time, when I'm out and about in the resort or when I'm in my red and gold bedroom, I won't feel obliged to think about my predicament at all. Having made this resolution, I feel happier and lighter. I go and get my handbag from the living room, open it, pull out my ultrasound photo, and take it back to the blue room. My 12 weeks pregnant photos of Jess and Ollie were grainy and hard to decipher, but this one is much clearer. If I had to guess, I'd say this one's a boy, and though no one who hasn't seen the photo would believe it, he looks as if he's raising one eyebrow. I know that's impossible. He's the size of a passion fruit, a month away from having eyebrows. Or is 12 weeks a small lemon? I can't remember. Only women who are pregnant for the first time obsess about which fruit most closely resembles their growing child at each gestational stage. I hold the photo in both hands for a few seconds, then put it down on the bed. My third baby. I am in Arizona, on holiday with my third child. The idea makes me smile. That's enough blue room thinking for now. I pick up the photo and return to the living room, where I notice straight away that something is different. There it is, today's mail, a white square on the floor by the casita's main door. It definitely wasn't there before. I feel a spurt of anxiety in case it's a letter explaining that I can't stay here. Rihanna wasn't authorized to be so generous on the resort's behalf. Or even worse, a note from Hairy Chessman, who has somehow found out where I ended up. Thankfully, it's neither. It's a printed note on a square card that has Swallowtail's embossed logo in the top left corner. If you would like fresh orange juice delivered to your casita each morning, please press the button by the side of the door so that the light comes on. No need to wake up early.
We will leave your juice in a cool box outside your door. Thank you.
What button? I look and see that there are three. One has a picture of a maid holding a vacuum cleaner, and another has the same picture with a big red line through it. The third has a picture of a glass with a straw in it. I press it, and it lights up with an orange glow. Wow. I put the ultrasound photo back in the safe pocket of my bag, zip it up, check that I've zipped it securely, and head out into the hot afternoon. Swallowtail's main restaurant is called Glorita's, and has as many tables outside as in. I've picked one on the terrace that has an amazing view of Camelback Mountain. A large white parasol protects me from the glare of the sun. I'm about to start looking through the options when a black-haired young man with flawless olive skin appears by my side.
Good afternoon, ma'am. I'm Philippe, and I'm going to be taking care of you today.
He smiles and holds out his hand. I feel like I have no choice but to shake it and tell him my name, though I wish I didn't have to. Lovely though he seems, I only want him to bring me some food, not become a lifelong friend. Ugh, I know what this is. It's my Englishness. It's going to embarrass me for as long as I'm in Arizona. At home, I'm considered normal. No one in Hertfordshire wants to get pally with the person who delivers their lunch. But the minute I set foot in a friendly country like America, I'm uptight and standoffish. To compensate for my cultural deficiency, I smile at Philippe till my jaw aches and tell him I'm nearly 13 weeks pregnant. It's his fault for asking if there's anything I don't eat. Oh, how adorable, he says. He waves at my stomach.
Hello, Cara's baby. Welcome to Arizona.
Tears prick my eyes. The idea that, after me, the person happiest about my pregnancy is a complete stranger who can't really care either way, who is nice by default because it's his job, makes me so angry. I want to yank the red cloth off my table and send all the cutlery flying. Thank goodness for sunglasses. Maybe the guests at all the other tables are also crying behind their dark lenses. Philippe has views about what I ought to eat and drink, and he sounds as if he knows what he's talking about. On his advice, I order Swallowtail's signature blueberry and oat smoothie and a casserole of butternut squash, chorizo and sweet-creamed grits, whatever they might be. While I wait for both to arrive, I look at what I brought with me from the folder in my casita. The two sheets of paper I picked out at random turn out to be a map of the resort and a list of activities available. There's enough here to keep anyone busy for 3 months at least. Guided hikes, canyon jeep tours, an art for beginners intensive 2-week course, tennis lessons, guided meditation, stargazing, vinyasa yoga, Native American flute workshops, a Vortexes and the Sacred seminar, an Ayurvedic medicine course. The list goes on in tiny print, filling up both sides of the page. There's a New Age theme to a lot of the options. I'm pretty sure now I think of it that I read something on the website about Arizona and Swallowtail in particular being some kind of spiritual hub, or something that meant hub. That's not the word they used. Normally any whiff of that sort of thing would have put me off. Instead, I found myself thinking that maybe this was somewhere that could lift the spirits, even of those of us who wince at the word sacred and want nothing to do with vortexes. At a table on the other side of the terrace, a blonde middle-aged woman wearing a white lace caftan, black shorts and high-heeled black sandals says to her companion, a teenage girl,
"The best choice, absolutely the best, always, is a gay man," the girl hisses.
"Shh, can you not shut up? What is wrong with you?" Must be a mother and daughter, American. I smile as the mother shakes out her long, loose, platinum blonde hair and says in an even louder voice,
"I could shut up if I wanted to. I don't want to." Ha, take that, teenage tyrant.
I wonder why the girl isn't at school. Maybe she's 18 or older and just young-looking for her age. Or the opposite. Maybe she's an ancient-looking 2 years old and cries when she spills fizzy drinks on her cuddly toys. Were they father and daughter, the man and the girl in the hotel room? I assume so, but I didn't hear her call him Dad.
Philippe's food and drink recommendations are not entirely successful. The smoothie is the most delicious thing I've ever tasted, but I don't much like the sweet creamed grits. Luckily, I'm hungry enough to not care. Philippe looks crushed when I reject his next piece of advice, which is to order the signature chocolate trio. It's apparently a life-changing dessert, and Philippe tries to suggest that my baby might benefit from having it even if I wouldn't, but I stand firm, promising to have it after dinner one night instead. Eventually he concedes defeat and brings me the bill to sign. I'm desperate to see the swimming pool, but as soon as I see it, I'll want to leap in, and I should probably digest my